Today, President Obama, in what looked like a hastily arranged press conference, announced and then apologized for the deaths of American hostage Warren Weinstein and Italian hostage Giovanni Laporto in a U.S. drone strike on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan this past January. It's the first known instance of an American drone accidentally killing hostages.
As a husband and as a father, I cannot begin to imagine the anguish that the Weinstein and Laporto families are enduring today. I realize that there are no words that can ever equal their loss. I know that there is nothing that I can ever say or do to ease their heartache. And today I simply want to say this. As president and as commander in chief, I take full responsibility for all our counterterrorism operations, including the one that inadvertently took the lives of Warren and Giovanni. I profoundly regret what happened.
It is also being reported today that two Americans working with al-Qaeda were also inadvertently killed in strikes. A top American-born al-Qaeda leader was killed in that same drone strike. And in another strike, one of al-Qaeda's chief propagandists, American-born Adam Gadan, was also killed. NPR's White House correspondent Scott Horsley has been following this breaking story today. And Scott, there have been hashtags and websites, you know, bring Warren Weinstein home. Start there. Many Americans may not know his name. What more do we know about him?
Warren Weinstein had been held captive for more than 3.5 years in Pakistan. He was a lifelong aid worker. He'd been a former Peace Corps volunteer. He'd worked for the U.S. Agency for International Development, and he was a USAID contractor at the time he was captured. The president said today there could be no starker contrast between the selfless individuals who were killed in this drone strike and their al-Qaeda captors. Weinstein, of course, was killed along with an Italian aid worker, Giovanni Laporto.
Yeah, and Weinstein had made a video, al-Qaeda released it in 2013, in which Weinstein said he felt totally abandoned by the U.S., but of course we don't know what pressure he was under while making that video. But what more do we know about this operation that accidentally killed the two hostages?
Well, just to speak to that video, obviously you have to take that with a grain of salt, but Weinstein's widow, Elaine, released a statement today. She offered praise for some members of the FBI who'd helped to try to free her husband, as well as some lawmakers, but she did express some criticism of other parts of the U.S. government, who saying their help had been inconsistent and disappointing over the last 3.5 years. She also criticized Pakistan's government and military for not doing more to rescue her husband. In the end, though, she said ultimate responsibility for Warren's death was with those who'd taken him captive, and she said their actions were not in keeping with Islam and that they would have to face their God to answer for those actions.
Well, to the operation that killed the two hostages, and we understand an American working for al-Qaeda, what more do we know about that?
Well, President Obama has ordered a full review of this to see what lessons might be learned. But he says it appears to, on first look, to meet the standards. That is, that this had been an identified al-Qaeda compound. It appeared to the U.S. that there were no civilians present, and it appeared there was no possibility for capturing the al-Qaeda targets who were there. Intelligence analysts had kept a close watch on this compound for hundreds of hours, but they were completely unaware that Weinstein and Laporto were being held there.
And then, as we mentioned, a drone strike also killed Adam Gadan, someone the U.S. has wanted for a while, an American working with al-Qaeda. Has the government responded to that news at all? That's been reported, but has anyone said anything about that?
Well, the government has said neither Gadan nor the other American-born al-Qaeda member who was killed in the same strike as Weinstein and Laporto, Ahmed Farouk, were specifically targeted. And that's significant because, of course, there are extra legal hoops that the government has to go through to justify targeting American citizens. In this case, those extra hoops do not apply. Because the government says they weren't targeted, and I suppose that's credible. If they didn't know Weinstein and Laporto were in the compound, it's certainly conceivable they didn't know that Farouk was there or that Gadan was in the separate target spot.
Well, as you say, this will all still be investigated and we'll continue to follow, but sad news today. Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent, thanks for following it for us.
My pleasure.
Well, the Art Institute of Chicago has announced the largest gift of art in the museum's history, with 42 pieces, including works by Andy Warhol and Jasper Johns. The gift, worth nearly $500 million, was donated by local philanthropists Stefan Edlis and Gail Neeson. It will go on display in January of next year. Douglas Druick is the Art Institute's president and director. He's with us from WBEZ in Chicago. Douglas, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And we say the biggest donation in the history of the Art Institute, but how significant is this for the Art Institute?
It's transformational. I mean, what we have always built on our collection of modern and contemporary art, and we have areas of great, great strength ranging from the Impressionists when they were contemporary in the 1890s through the 20th century, Picasso, Matisse, and the School of Paris, Surrealism. What's so wonderful about this collection is that it builds on strength, and we always wish to do that because the more works you have by a great artist, the more you can tell the story of that artist and his or her place in history. But we also are now filling gaps. The area that we were weak in was pre-pop art and pop art, and getting a great early Jasper Johns, a great early Rauschenberg, and now 9 works by Warhol, we can tell a story, that the story of that moment in time, which was seismic in the history of art, we can tell it with much greater nuance and complexity and enjoyment.
Stefan Edlis, who donated this collection along with Gail Neeson, sits on the board of the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, has supported the new museum, the Whitney, the Guggenheim. How did the Art Institute managed to secure this donation, which I guess could have been given to a number of other museums?
This is one of the things that comes about through a long relationship with a collector. People in museums are passionate about works of art. Collectors, the best of them, are all likewise passionate. So over the years, you talk about your shared passion. It could be sports. It also could be works of art. I think one of the things that was very attractive to both Stefan and to Gail was the fact that thanks to our grand new modern wing, which houses modern and contemporary, we could offer wonderful space in which to put a collection such as Stefan's. I mean, I think Stefan very strongly feels, and he said it in certain press releases, that he doesn't want to really give art that is going to remain off public view and in the storage most of the time.
Right. He told the Chicago Tribune that he's very frustrated that museums show donated works only for a short period of time and then they go right into the storage area.
Well, we're doing quite the opposite. I mean, this is a wonderful collection. We want to have it up all the time, and there's a guarantee that we will have it up in its totality as an exhibition, as a special exhibition in a way, for some 25 years, and it will be up for the next 25 years thereafter. And look, when we have great works of art like, let's say, the Seurat Grand Jatte, we don't take them off view.
How do you secure artwork as a museum when it's not a gift like this? The price of art has skyrocketed. You're dealing with collectors who have priced a lot of museums out of the market. What do you do when you have to go out and buy the art these days?
Well, what you do is you work around the market to the best that you can. I mean, what we're trying to do is identify those artists who we believe in now who may be future superstars but have not quite got there yet. I mean, there are some wonderful examples in our past where we've been right on. I mean, we bought the Grant Wood American Gothic, that signature American painting, the same year that it was painted. We've done that a few times. So if you get in early, obviously you're not dealing with a competitive market with so many people in it.
But does that bring people into the museum when you've got something that may not be as well known?
But what happens is something that wasn't well known can, over time, as more and more people see it and recognize it to be truly remarkable, what was yesterday's acquisition of a young artist can be tomorrow's iconic work that brings droves and droves and droves of people to the museum and becomes one of the most iconic images, quite frankly, in the world, like our Grand Jatte. But, you know, it's not a science. So sometimes we're right on, and occasionally you buy for relatively little money, a work by a young artist that won't be considered to be so interesting 50 years on. But it's always a test. I mean, you know, our batting average is pretty damn good. And also, we have collectors in Chicago who are extraordinarily discerning and have played, particularly in the early years, but still now, in a way, a curatorial role, because so many people, so much of the works of art that we show in the museum are from private collections. So in a way, what you see when you go through our galleries is not only the history of modern and contemporary art, but it's also the history of Chicago's almost unique devotion to modern and contemporary art. And what's wonderful in the modern wing is that you're looking at these works of art, then you're looking at the city, at the city and the skyline, the home of the skyscraper. And it's a Chicago story. It's an art story, but it's a Chicago story.
Douglas Drewick, president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, which has just gotten the biggest gift in its history. Douglas Drewick, thank you so much.
And thank you for having me.
The latest map from the U.S. Drought Monitor is out today and shows 46% of the state of California in the most severe level of drought. That is up slightly from last week and almost twice what it was a year ago. 99.8% of California is in some level of drought right now, a drought that is in its fourth year, and when it will end is anybody's guess. But if worst-case scenarios are correct, it could last for years, and that is something that Australia knows a thing or two about. It suffered a drought that lasted from 1995 to 2012 and fundamentally changed the way the country uses water. So what can California learn from Australia? Joining us via Skype from Melbourne, Australia is Rebecca Nelson, a senior fellow at the University of Melbourne School of Law and a fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University. Rebecca, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, and take us back to the drought in Australia from 1995 to 2012. How bad was it? How did Australia cope with it?
Well, I think the numbers that you just gave there in terms of the duration give you a hint. I mean, it was the worst drought on record, the worst drought in living memory. And the way that Australia dealt with it was through fairly significant changes to laws and fairly significant changes to the ways that people used water in their everyday lives. So we had the federal government coming in to control the use of water for the first time ever, which in the United States context sounds a little shocking, and it was shocking in Australia as well. But I guess desperate times call for desperate measures. We had extreme restrictions on the ways that people could use water in their households and in their yards. And we had caps put on the amount of water that could be withdrawn from basins all over the eastern side of the country.
And how long did it take to get to that point till the government decided to put these caps on?
In 2007, the federal government passed a very significant law that placed those caps on basins across the East Coast. But there were previously caps that were in place, although they were a little spotty around the place. So the 2007 law made those extend across the most important basin, the Murray-Darling Basin in the eastern states. So it was a fundamental change, but it was also an evolution from a situation that had been changing since 1995.
The other thing that people have been looking at in California is farmers who are not as affected by the mandatory cuts as regular people living in Los Angeles or San Francisco. How did Australia deal with their farmers during the drought?
Farmers had to cut back their water use very significantly. Allocations that were made against water rights were in many cases 0%. So if you had a water right, it was a right on paper only, and you didn't get any wet water against that right. So farmers definitely had to cut back use and were feeling the pain as much, if not more, than people in cities.
Australia also put in place restrictions that are still in place today. There are meters that really monitor everybody's water usage that they didn't have before that drought.
That's right. So anything above a certain minimum amount of water use is metered. It provides more information into the system, more data that you can use to manage your water system, because if water's short, then you need to manage all the water that's there effectively. If we're thinking about water restrictions in place in cities, what were in the drought considered to be exceptional restrictions are now permanent water-saving rules. So water conservation activities that were seen as exceptional are now seen as commonplace and everyday.
Rebecca, the other thing that has come up in California is obviously how the environment fits into this and how much water should go to help certain kinds of fish in California, or should it be rerouted and sent down to help farmers? How did Australia balance that, the balance between the environment and the economy?
That tension between the environment and the economy was the absolute number one issue in Australia during the drought. And it was dealt with in law in ways that were very contentious at the time and continue to be contentious, because the law said that you have to set aside water for key ecological assets, depending on your interpretation of the law, either first or in equal priority to water for human needs. So by providing for key assets, it's a more transparent process. People know where the water's going and how it's going there.
Did Australia resort to spending a lot of money on desalination projects or pipelines to take water from a wetter part of the country to some of the drier parts?
Yes, particularly in my home state, the state of Victoria, they did both of those things. So we had a multi-billion dollar desalination plant built, and we also had a very significant billion-dollar pipeline from the northern part of the state to the southern part of the state built. Both of those projects are now, in a wet period, not in use. And while people saw that they were really important infrastructure measures during drought, those kinds of costs become fairly controversial when they're not being used during wet periods.
Do you think it was a mistake to build them?
Personally, I do not think it was a mistake. I think that when it starts raining, people forget what drought is like. But in a climate like the climate that we have, which is a boom and bust climate, we will have drought again, and those infrastructure measures will be necessary again. You might want to quibble about exactly how they were built, but I think you don't want to waste a good crisis to put in place measures that will make dealing with the next crisis easier.
So given all that you know about the drought in Australia, what should California be doing right now to deal with its drought?
Don't waste the crisis. Make sure that with the momentum and the concern and the attention on the issue, that proactive measures are taken to deal with it, not just now, but to make sure that when the next drought comes, there's a way of dealing with it so that the crisis isn't quite so severe. For example, in terms of groundwater use in California, measure it. Measure what you're using. Implement your laws a little quicker to get to a more sustainable management regime so that the next time this thing comes around, you'll be more prepared for it. And don't forget about the environment. Groundwater supports ecological assets as well as human consumptive purposes. It's not just about surface water and fish. It's about the forests. It's about groundwater discharging to streams. I think that was a lesson learned in Australia, that you need to look at the water cycle as a whole. And when drought happens, recognize the value of all elements of that water cycle.
And what grade would you give the state of California on how it's performing on those things right now?
In relation to groundwater, it would maybe be a bear pass.
And what about environment, balancing the environment?
So I'm going to focus here on groundwater because that's my area of expertise. I don't think there is at all a sufficient recognition in California that groundwater supports ecosystems. I think people think about groundwater and almond farms, and they don't think about groundwater discharging to rivers, being vital for rivers and supporting fish or supporting springs in the desert or anything like that. So I think there needs to be a major leap in awareness on that front. And there's a major way for law to go to follow up that awareness with protection for those systems.
Rebecca, as we said, California is entering year four of drought. Australia's lasted for 17 years. We're already, though, hearing stories in California about what this means for the future of the state. Is California going to be a place that can have tens of millions of people and be the state that provides 50% of the fruits and vegetables in the United States? Can it really continue to be the California that we know? With all of your experience, what do you think? Is that overblown? Should we just, cool it a little bit and think about how to deal with the drought, but not think it's going to change the state forever, or what?
I think maybe the nature of agriculture could well change. If I reflect on the Australian situation during the drought, it happened that rice farmers were no longer really able to farm rice in the Murray-Darling Basin because there wasn't enough water. But because higher value crops and higher value croppers can afford to pay more for water, can buy water from those rice farmers, there's a lot more vineyards. There are a lot more horticultural activities, and there's a lot less rice and cotton. So if water is able to move through water markets, which is what happened in Australia as a key measure to deal with the drought, being able to sell and buy water so that it moves to its highest value use, then I see no reason why agriculture can't continue. It just might look a little different than what it looks like today.
That's Rebecca Nelson, a senior fellow at the University of Melbourne School of Law, also a fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment at Stanford University in California. Rebecca, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And now to last night's troubling emergency landing of SkyWest Flight 5622. It landed in Buffalo while traveling from Chicago to Hartford. SkyWest initially said the pilot performed the emergency landing because one passenger had passed out. But according to medical personnel, two more passengers also lost consciousness during the flight. A nurse who was on board said she came to their aid, and she and other passengers also started feeling ill. Then panic swept through the cabin as the plane rapidly descended. Clive Irving is an aviation expert and contributor to the Daily Beast. And Clive, the FAA says initial information indicated the jet may have had a depressurization problem, but they later concluded that was incorrect. So what are your thoughts from a distance, certainly, but if the FAA says it wasn't a loss of cabin pressure, what does that tell you?
This is a classic case, I think, one of the worst cases I've known, actually, of misinformation and garbled stories. It's been a very difficult story to cover, as you know, because it's gone through several versions. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important to say what didn't happen. I don't think it was a depressurization problem, because the clue to that is the oxygen masks would have been dropped down for the passengers had that been the case. And as far as I know, they were not dropped down. Mm-hmm. But I think what we're dealing with here is a situation in airlines now where people are easily spooked, and there's nothing spooks people more than a sudden descent, particularly in association with what happened with the Germanwings flight, which is also a sudden descent.
Well, in this case, the plane dropped for 8 minutes, nearly 7,000 feet a minute.
Yeah, well, that's pretty standard. If the pilot feels that he's got to go down to 10,000 feet, which is where, if there is a depressurization problem, then the pressure outside the plane and inside the plane becomes equalized. So there's a contradiction here in that the pilot apparently did something which he would normally do if there were a depressurization problem, but there wasn't a depressurization problem, everybody now says. So why did they make that rapid descent? Mm-hmm. And it can't be just because some of the passengers were affected and others were not, because depressurization is not selective. If you have any kind of depressurization, it can sometimes occur because of a door. If the door seal is defective or is not being closed properly, you can get what's called a very slow leak. But it doesn't just affect the people sitting near the door. It would affect the whole cabin. So there's another problem in understanding what happened here. And I think both the FAA and the airline need to come up with a very clear explanation, because there are these spooky associations with sudden descents, yeah. Because, you know.
Well, the nurse we mentioned said she was called to help a passenger who passed out, and that person recovered after being given some oxygen. The nurse went back to her seat and was called back. The person next to the person who had passed out had also passed out. So people were passing out and then recovering when being given oxygen.
Yes. Well, there again, you see, you have this paradox. And there isn't any mechanical or other kind of explanation.
Well, obviously, the investigations continue. What just one question would you ask?
I would want to know what caused the pilot to make that sudden dive. Was it something that he saw on his instrumentation, or was it a miscommunication between the cabin staff and the flight deck? Because someone spoke to someone and said they got a problem, and the pilot's response was to do that. We need an answer exactly to what did the pilot do and why did he do it.
Yeah. That's Clive Irving, aviation expert, contributor to the Daily Beast. Clive, thank you.
You're welcome.
And now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Chris Doritas is DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica. He has also been a music supervisor for a number of Hollywood films, and he's with us now. Chris, welcome to Here and Now.
Hey, very good to be with you.
Great to have you, and let's get right to some of the music you wanted us to hear. This is the Montreal artist Eric Woodhead, who goes by Doldrums. This is called Hotfoot. Tell us about Doldrums.
Wow, there's so much going on in this track. I mean, it's just, there's chaos, there's anxiety, there's this throwaway performance by the vocals, and yet it's exhilarating. You know, it almost feels like it's going to roll off the track somehow, but it just draws you in. It's an exciting piece, and it's brand new. I just stumbled over this thing. And it's like my favorite thing right now.
Well, and the artist here, Eric Woodhead, apparently made this album himself on a friend's laptop. He told the website Pitchfork that the laptop was broken by the time he was done. But what was it that caught your ear about this song?
I mean, I guess it's just the exhilaration of it. You know, the drums are great. It's a little uncomfortable to listen to at first, so it kind of raises your hackles a little bit. Mm. And I like the weird in it. That always pulls me in. Yet it's still melodic. You know, I kind of, yeah. It's got hooks.
Well, let's get to another one you wanted us to hear. This is the group Bombadil. This is Framboise.
Tu es dans un beau, l'offre fan, trop beau. I thought you knew, c'est du déjà vu. A man to know how far, but you never left and you've been starred, and it makes me feel infinite to think of yourself this way. Tu es bourgeoise, presque comme une framboise. I can tell, mademoiselle, that you're too rare to be sunburned. What it is I can't discern, and it makes you uncomfortable to think of yourself this way.
So I should say, number one, it sounds like something that might have been made in the early 70s. And number two, they are not French. They're from Durham, North Carolina.
From Durham, North Carolina. You know, there's something, I don't know, innocent about it. It's almost got a sing-song quality to it, a children's wonderment about it.
Yeah.
I have a real soft spot for French pop, too. Like the ya-ya scene from the 60s is a big thing with me. And I like the inventiveness of the writing, too. I mean, it sticks out, you know, in the firmament of contemporary music right now.
What do you mean by that?
Well, it's not like anything else. I mean, there's a lot of artists with guitars or singer-songwriters with guitars, but the way that they do this track is surprising. There's an element of surprise to the way that they build the track.
Well, on to another one, and we'll see how big of a surprise this is. This is an artist called Grace. This song features Jeezy. It's something that people may have heard a different version of, but this is You Don't Own Me.
You don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
A very sultry take on the Leslie Gore classic from 1963. What do you like about this one, Chris Doritas?
Well, you know, it's funny. The big major label push that comes with a lot of records can sometimes put me off. But this one, coming from Columbia Records, is a first single from this young girl named Grace. And she pairs up with Jeezy, who's a big rapper. for a redo on a song that I've always loved from the 60s. And it was originally produced by Quincy Jones. And what caught my eye and ear about this one when I first came across it was that Quincy Jones was involved in this one too. And, so I checked out the cover and I was knocked out.
Well, and it's total hit or miss there. You could have a really great cover of this, or it could really just not match up to the original. But you think this one does. It's good enough.
I thought they nailed it. I thought they made it fresh enough, but not too, they didn't go too far. There's a great balance in it. It's got nostalgia. It feels fresh. And the pairing of Jeezy and Grace is, I just think, perfect.
All right, let's get to another one. This is from the British singer-songwriter Jamie Scott. This is called Ebony Eyes.
Ebony eyes like desire, they're waiting for me to come home. Then she walks in her high heels in my direction. In your hand I see you're drinking whiskey. Hit the floor and your lips begin to move. This is what I've been waiting for. You ain't got to say a word to me at all.
It does sound a little Elliot Smithy.
Really? You know what I think of when I hear this is that sort of languid ease that came with Norah Jones' breakthrough. Mm. Don't Know Why, remember the big hit?
Yeah,
she had?
Yeah.
It's got that kind of languid comfort to it. I encourage you to hear the entire track because it's just gorgeous. And Jamie Scott, I've followed his band Graffiti 6 and I've seen them live. He's very captivating and he's an incredible songwriter, and Ebony Eyes is beautiful. And I encourage you to check out the whole album.
And actually, on his Facebook page, Jamie Scott says he's inspired by Carole King, Paul Simon, you could hear that, Cat Stevens, Joni Mitchell. A lot of inspiration there from people from many decades ago.
You know, I think you can find that true about all of these songs, that they're great songs, quality songs.
Well, let's get to one more that we have time for. This is the Swedish indie rock band Pale Honey. This is called Youth. Interesting sound there. Very different from some of the other songs you've brought us. This is a band, by the way, that refers to itself as a minimalist rock duo. It's just two women in this.
I love it. they come from Sweden. You know, there's, like Wolf Alice, there are a couple of bands right now that are just fronted by these girls who just got, everything's kind of full out forward, and I love it. There's a lot of bands that have come out of Sweden in recent years, but this one kind of takes a different turn. And they only have a couple of EPs, but this is the newest EP. It's called Youth, and I can't wait to hear more from them.
How would you describe this? What would you, if somebody asked, what kind of music is that? What would you say?
I'm so bad with genres. I mean, at KCRW, we mix genres like constantly, so it's all a big,
you can just call everything eclectic and think that's enough.
Yeah, I call this Pale Honey. That's the name of the band. Yeah.
All right, Chris Doritas, DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, and you can hear all of these picks that we've played today at our website, hearandnow.org. You can find all of our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. Chris, thanks so much for joining us.
Jeremy, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Now to the news that the NFL might have to spend as much as $1 billion to resolve thousands of concussion lawsuits. You followed the reporting. The NFL has been dogged for years by complaints that it hid the risks of repeated concussions to keep players on the field. Plaintiffs like Kevin Turner, a former player for the Philadelphia Eagles and the New England Patriots, sued. Turner, who has Lou Gehrig's disease, said after the deal was announced, what matters now is time, and many retired players don't have much left. Christopher Seeger is one of the attorneys for the retired NFL players.
The retired player community overwhelmingly supports this agreement and is eager to begin taking advantage of its benefits. In fact, throughout this process, the most common question we've heard from retired players has been, how quickly can we get help?
Well, the payout process could start as soon as this summer. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst, also host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And so, Mike, tell us more. What are some of the details of this plan?
Well, it will span 65 years. It could cost the NFL $900 million or more. The pay will be based on the severity of the injury, also the longevity of the player's career.
Well, and what does that mean? Because I think I heard a pro player this morning say, you know, how is this going to affect players who are much older, much nearer the end of their life? Will they get a lot more than somebody who's younger and will need support for many more years?
No, it will go by a number of things, including how long the player was in the league. But then there will be, for instance, dementia has a dollar amount attached to it. Early onset dementia is a few million dollars attached to it. The highest award would be in the several millions of dollars for a player who's played 10 years and had ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. But there will be many lesser awards that are designed to help players throughout their careers. And I think the lawyer was accurate. Sometimes they're not, but in this case, they are. There are a few players, Junior Seau is the most famous, who didn't sign on. But the players want what they can get now. And a lot of them are already suffering, and a lot of them are worried about suffering. So if they could get their money now, they'd be happy. And this is why they favored the deal even when the dollar amount wasn't as high as it was now. It was the judge, Anita Brody, who said, no, we don't want just a cap of $675 million. You have to take off that cap. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be, the judge is saying, I don't want to be in a position to approve an award, and it turns out that that is insufficient to pay all the players for their ailments. So it's uncapped now.
Yeah, and you mentioned Judge Jody. She's rejected a deal twice before. She asked for different things like partial credit for time played in NFL Europe. What else did she want?
Well, yes, the big issue was the cap on how much total the NFL will pay. But both sides say it really shouldn't be much more. They don't expect it to be much more than that number, 675. And if we're hearing a different figure that, like, as you said in the introduction, that the total settlements may be upwards of near $1 billion, well, you have to take into account things like lawyers' fees, and that could be over $100 million. There's also a $75 million allotment for a program of baseline examinations of players for brain impairment and counseling and treatment. In fact, that was capped too. That was capped at 75. Now that cap has been taken off. Once again, same thing. Yeah. Both sides don't think it will cost that much more, but if it has to cost much more, the judge said that the NFL will have to pay it.
And just briefly, I think I just heard you say something that alludes to this. So now players might be more willing to get brain scans if, in fact, that's going to mean that they might get some payment. Because I'm thinking that some of these degenerative diseases aren't found until after someone's died.
Yes, there is a new test being done by UCLA that promises to diagnose chronic traumatic encephalopathy. But right now, it can only be done after an autopsy. That was actually a point of contention. Can we, you know, have funding for more methods to find CTE? And that was not part of this agreement.
Yeah. Well, Mike, we remember last month, San Francisco 49ers linebacker Chris Borland shocked everybody. He'd just completed his rookie season, had everything, you know, laid out for him. And then he retired because he was concerned over head injuries. So this is obviously, this is not going away.
It's not going away, but I think the NFL is happy with this agreement, as happy as they could be said to be, because they're a $10 billion industry. They make about $10 billion in revenue a year when you add it all up. So this one-time payment of less than $1 billion is sort of a kind of horrible cost of doing business, but they'd look at it like a cost of doing business. Now, on the other side, a lot of people who are very sympathetic to the players, and many of them absolutely deserve the sympathy, say, aren't they settling for little? But you have to realize realize that the court, there's no ruling in this case. There's no admission of guilt. And it's very unclear if the players would have won. I mean, they collectively bargained their health. And so there, that was a big hurdle to clear. There was so much uncertainty on both sides. It could have been possible that the players would have lost, but the trial would have been so embarrassing that both sides wouldn't have wanted that outcome. So that's why you have this outcome, which is the players get some of what they want, and the NFL gets to say that this issue is at least sidelined for now.
Is it because you mentioned players who didn't accept the deal? They're going to have lawsuits.
They are, but from this point forward, so much more is known about the dangers. Now, if you go back to Junior Seau and if you go back to players of that generation, the NFL is still or could be possibly on the hook for payments there. But yeah, from this point forward, I mean, what the retirements, early retirements of the players indicate to me are that NFL players are going into this with more information than they've ever had before. Not that it's a safe game, but maybe more informed choices can be made.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thanks as always.
You're welcome.